Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome back to Season 2 of the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place to hear from today's leaders in the fields of data, customer insight, data science, analytics, and AI. As I shared in the preview episode for this season, a new emphasis for these conversations is digging into some of those all-important softer skills and learning from people's experience. I'm your host, Paul Loughlin, and with me today is David Merrick. David is a genuine expert in marketing analytics and modeling. Many years ago, he was co-author with the late great Professor Bob Shaw of the classic text Marketing Payback, which I've praised before in my review on the blog. He's also a founder of specialist modeling and analytics agency Quantalize, whose econometric models and software have set a gold standard in that discipline. Something we'll explore during today's conversation is the wealth of practical experience that David brings with him, both technical and commercial. Unlike so many on social media these days, David has genuinely been there and done that. Plus, his contribution has stood the test of time with regards to adding value to the clients he's worked with and the advice that he's shared. A great analytics leader for us all to learn from before he chooses to finally hang up his boots one day. Welcome, David.
It's a pleasure to be here, Paul.
Pleasure to have you with us as well. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I'm sure many stories that you have to share. With all my guests, David, I like to start us off by getting them to share their backstories so listeners know where they're coming from, the experience they're drawing from. And of course, you have quite a few years of backstory to share. So please tell us about your career story. What patterns do you see might be interesting to notice as we go along, as you've developed over your career?
Well, indeed, it started a long, long time ago. I read maths at university. I was the first from either side of the family to go to university. So when I graduated, with that family background, there was no real advice about careers. Sure. I honestly had no idea what I wanted to do. I had some discussions with what was then the National Coal Board.
Right.
They had a research establishment whose function was to look at new and more efficient ways of using coal. I know in the current awareness of climate change and coal's role in climate change that seems like a very different era. And in many ways it was. But the work seemed interesting, and so that's where I started. I think I'd just like to back up and say, obviously that came to an end, and I look back on my career and think of it in terms of three quite separate phases. Okay. There was the coal industry phase. Mm-hmm. There was then a period in the mid to late 90s and early noughties where my work was mainly as a consultant yes. for the World Bank. Right. And then, as you said in your introduction, I moved into marketing analytics, and I've been in that role for more than 20 years. So going back to the coal board and the research establishment, they were a very good employer, and I remember when I joined them, I said to myself, I'll do this until I find out what I really want to do in life. And that was the mindset, but they were very good. to me and kept giving me new opportunities and new challenges. They enable me to do my PhD externally. Mm-hmm. I was able to write three books while I was with them. Okay. But I think that probably one of the key developments in this period was that in my first year, I did some original research, generated a mathematical model of one of their processes. And there was an invitation that arrived from the American Institute of Chemical Engineers for a paper. And so, of course, my boss went to the meeting in the States to present my work. Mm. I was ambitious, and so I let it be known that if such a situation were to occur again, I thought it should be me that went to present the paper.
Good for you.
So no need for assertiveness training at that stage of my career. The next year, I did a different piece of original work and another mathematical model of a different aspect of one of their processes, and another invitation arrived. And lo and behold, this time I was invited to go. I'd never presented a paper to anyone. I had a lot of help from colleagues in preparing the presentation, but everything changed at the last minute. Because the approval for this expenditure, flying over to New York, etc., had to be done by the board member. And he looked at this and thought, that could be an interesting conference. I think I should go. And and another senior manager, Jim Harrison, as well. So as he was board member, the rule was that we all traveled in the class of the most senior member of the group.
Oh, nice.
That was first class. So I had never flown before. I'd certainly never been to the States before. So suddenly, within a week's notice, I was upgraded to first class and flying with Leslie Granger and Jim Harrison to New York. So it was all quite stressful, particularly the presentation. Mm. It was an audience of 300 or 400 mm. with the board members sitting in the first row.
Wow.
But
it must have been by fire, isn't it, of that kind of learning?
Absolutely. But it must have gone all right, because he then adopted me as a bag carrier, got me to write speeches. And of course, then early 70s, there was the oil crisis and the role of coal was suddenly much more important. And so there was a lot of invitations for papers for the board member. And he very kindly took me with him on many such occasions. So that was a very exciting period. But I did lots of other things in the coal industry. After several years, it was suggested to me that I make a move to the Internal Management Training College, which was housed at an Elizabethan country manor in Buckinghamshire.
It's a different, isn't it, when big corporates had these lovely management colleges in the countryside?
Absolutely. This one was particularly beautiful because it was formerly owned by the Palliser family, who financed Captain Cook's exploratory voyages.
Oh, my word.
Yes, it had many trees in the 70 acres of woodlands, which were grown from saplings that he brought back.
Sure.
So that was quite a step change, but it was suggested that I do that because it would provide me with more visibility within the coal industry. And I found it very stressful at first. I don't think I was a good presenter at first either. Mm. But I grew to find my own way of doing it, and I grew to love it. And I recall first being in awe at the old hands who would arrive at the college 5 or 10 minutes before their session, casually talking over a cup of coffee and then wander in and totally command the audience as if, you know, nothing had happened until one day I realized I was doing exactly the same. So it sort of creeps up on you. So and that was also the period where, well, just as a bit of background, it was quite an intimidating environment, 35 to 40 people, mainly from the coal fields. A typical session was an hour and a half. And everyone, I think, went through the same journey because no one was prepared to hand over their teaching material. You had to generate your own. One of the things I did, and I retain an interest in this, is I developed some business games. And I found them extremely effective and powerful as learning tools. But that period came to an end when they offered to put me in charge of one of their wholly owned subsidiary companies, which I ran for a couple of years. I was then moved into marketing, which was interesting as well. And I ended up in the internal group responsible for the privatization.
Right.
Which was fascinating because I was interacting with investment banks and city legal firms. But there are only two outcomes. You either fail in getting the privatization done, which is never good for a career, or if you succeed, there's no job. And it was at that point that I decided to go into consultancy. And indeed, I'd already started because while I was still at British Coal in the final days of my period with them, I was asked to write a report for the World Bank on privatization lessons to be learned. Mm-hmm. And they received this report and then asked me to go over to Washington, D.C. to make a presentation on it. And following that, they invited me to do consultancy work for them in Russia, Ukraine, Romania, Poland, and Zambia. And that was all on privatization and restructuring. Mm-hmm. And that lasted until the early noughties. Mm-hmm. And then I moved back to what I do think was probably my natural place anyway, of applying my maths, which I've always used and loved, but applying it to marketing and embracing the field of marketing analytics. Mm-hmm. And although that's, as I said, probably my natural place, and I've been on quite a journey to get there, I've no regrets about the journey, Paul.
Great. That's good to know. And I imagine in your work since founding Quantalize, it's probably quite a diverse range of sectors and businesses that you've helped, that you've applied your econometric and other mathematical modelling to.
It is. Having said that, most of my clients are in the media and consultancy sector, because most of the, not all, but most of the work I've done is what I would call white label work, where
I see.
As a subcontractor,
yeah,
rather than directly to the end client.
Right, got you. Yeah, you know, that makes sense. And it is the work of people like you that is how some of these big media agencies do suddenly have econometric expertise out of the cupboard. I've experienced the surprise of the technical capability suddenly appearing. Thanks for sharing that, David. And one of the joys that I looked forward to on this podcast was a chance much more in this episode to take a long view over a longer career and the greater time you've had to reflect on things and see some of the lessons learned. There are things you've shared which are more in common with a number of guests I've had on this podcast. A number have benefited from working in different countries and moving overseas. A number have benefited from different sectors, from working kind of client side and agency side. So those themes are helpful but familiar. So I'll choose rather to pick up on some of the things that I think were a bit different in your story. If I go right back, really, to the time around when you, or soon after you managed to have that lovely first class flight to the America, you use this term bag carrier, which I suspect isn't used that much these days. And I suspect the role of being a bag carrier, that supportive speech writer and kind of someone almost like, I guess a lot of that work would be called an executive assistant these days, to a senior exec, that might sound too menial to some of today's leaders, particularly people who've got like data or analytics skills. They might think, oh, I wouldn't want to be the sort of exec assistant, the odd job person for a senior exec. Sounds like you really benefited from it. Would you recommend others take such an opportunity?
Definitely. What I found it did was that it exposed me firsthand and over an extended period to how people who were in very senior positions, how they coped, how what they did, right, and how they were totally on top of their brief. I learned a lot from that level of exposure. And so I would very much recommend it. It isn't as menial actually as it sounds, because some of the problems required some analytics. I can give it maybe a couple of anecdotes.
Yeah. Would that be helpful? Go on, David.
Help on this. So one was a request came in to Leslie Granger, the board member, from the publication Nature, asking whether he'd like to submit a paper on a fossil fuel perspective on fast breeder reactors. Mm-hmm. And rather than doing that, he said to me, David, I'd like you to do this. And I said, oh, fine, what would you like? No, he said, I want you to be the author. So he actually passed that to me. And I thought, well, what am I going to say? So I had to go up a quick learning curve about fast breeder reactors. And what I discovered was that the claim that was made that they used uranium 60 times more efficiently than conventional nuclear reactors, that claim ignored the fuel that you had to put into the core to start with. Ah. And when you took into account the fact that you had to build the thing and put fissile material in the core to start with, that factor of 60 dropped to a much lower value, I think somewhere in range 3 to 5. And that was the central tenet of the paper. So there was actually quite a bit of analytics that I had to do to fulfill that particular remit. I think the other point that impressed me, and I'll go forward to the privatization period, the chairman at that point was Neil Clark. I remember on one occasion, he was summoned to the Department of Energy, and the board secretary wasn't available, and neither was the deputy board secretary. So I was asked to accompany him, strictly to take notes, not to make any contribution to the meeting, but to take notes. And so we were swept into the underground entrance and up to the conference room. And there was the minister and 6 civil servants, and each of the civil servants had specialized in a particular area. And it was quite an aggressive and confrontational meeting. And he dealt with everything totally on top of the brief, everything from the pension scheme to coal stocks to last year's subsidies or whatever. But what I learned was how he defused the situation by always being gracious, however barbed the question was. He never rose to it. He dealt with everything with superb grace and detail. I just found that very impressive and not something that stayed with me.
Nice. What a lovely life lesson to be gracious with people and on top of your brief. You don't really hear the combo stress.
No.
Another thing that I noticed in your story, which I felt was a bit different and so worth exploring, was the move from having been in a more research lab type environment, if I understand correctly, to then training others at the management college. Again, another unusual one, a little bit of a different time, but I recognise there might be quite strong parallels because these days a lot of data scientists get more of a chance to work in a genuine lab type environment within large corporates, but might assume the only way forward for them is that technical route. Would you recommend that technical people today who are working in a lab environment would think of such a radical move to a commercial training environment?
I do think it's worth considering. For me, it worked very well. What it did, as I said, I don't regard myself as having presentation as one of my key skills. I had to work on it, and I came to my own way of doing it. And you know, I think that's true of many people. But I think the two things I learned very quickly by being thrown in at the deep end, as everyone was there, was firstly to be very clear about what the messages are that you want to convey, and that clarity, I think, then. That is something that I've tried to carry forward in my subsequent career steps. And secondly, and this is just my way of doing it, focus on the content rather than on the words. And I would say a little bit further, content and the concepts. So I would not have particular words in my mind that I was going to say. I didn't learn a script. But I had the ideas that I wanted to convey. I had a very clear view. I forced myself to have a very clear view of what the key ideas were and how I was going to approach conveying those key messages and concepts.
Yeah, that makes sense. So if I'm understanding
and,
right.
And those skills then carried forward. So that's why I'd recommend it.
Right. Sorry, David. Yeah, no, that makes sense. If I've understood right, it's much more of a focus on mastering and understanding yourself, your subject matter, and the logical argument you're seeking to make. So you've got that well grounded. And then in the moment, how you communicate it can just come naturally. Would that be right?
Absolutely right. Yes. And I think the reason that that does work for me is that when I'm in front of an audience, I do want to interact with them. And that's why I don't have a script, because I'm looking at the audience and I'm thinking, have they actually understood what I've just said? Has there been a misinterpretation? And if I had a script, I would feel constrained. So I don't have a script, but I'm focusing on the ideas and trying to be interactive with the audience. Now, obviously, it depends on the size of the audience. And, you know, if it's 300 or 400 people, then that's difficult. But for smaller presentations, that would be my approach.
That makes good sense. Given you've touched on interactive, perhaps it's worth exploring also your business game. I know I've blogged before about how powerful I think they are, what positive experience I've had at them as well. Did you find it was a very effective training media? Was it more effective using the business game than chalk and talk, to use that term?
Absolutely. One of the one of the sessions that we did when I was at the management college was finance for non-financial managers, I never delivered that session myself, but it was a really difficult session because people really weren't interested in the intricacies of a balance sheet or profit and loss.
Yeah, sure.
But you put together a business game which has a profit and loss and balance sheet and tell them you're running a business in competition with four other businesses and it is interactive. And what you find is you've no need to tell them that their objective is to win. They straight away fasten onto that.
Yeah.
But the issue is they don't understand what winning actually is. And in order to, and I don't tell them what winning is. But in order, because they want so strongly to win, they find their own way of looking at the financial statements and understanding the levers and how, if you pull this lever, that will change and this lever will change something else. They learn it themselves because of the motivation that a business game gives them. And that is why I think it's such a powerful and rounded approach to training.
That's a great answer. Thank you, David. Very, very insightful. I can see lots of more innovative and progressive approaches to education kind of ringing true with that as well. A focus for this second series of the podcast, which I should come to in this conversation, is softer skills. I'm wondering if I asked you to notice a softer skill that's been key to your development, would it be something around this content presentation theme that's emerged?
I think it would definitely be presentations. Curiously, because it's not something I regard as one of my strengths, but if I look back, the presentation early on in New York was a turning point. When I was interviewed for the position on the directing staff of the management college, a key part of that interview was a presentation, which I put together based on some consultancy I'd carried out in Botswana. And I was off the job, so that must have gone all right.
Yes.
And then when I was put in charge of the subsidiary company, I was invited to attend a meeting by the deputy chairman, Ken Moses, and I was invited to make a presentation on international threats to the British coal industry.
Right.
And that must have gone well because it was he that brought me into the privatization team a couple of years later.
Right. Right, yes, as you say, then definitely a repeating pattern of it served you well, whether you consider yourself to have a natural skill in it or not. But perhaps it would be interesting to explore for our listeners some of that theme of what you meant by content that you mentioned before. It sounds like that's been key to the success of your presentations. And as you were sharing, it was this combo of mastery of your subject matter, really understanding your logical argument. I'd like to explore it a bit more because I'm very conscious that a lot of the advice out there in books and social media today stresses instead the externals, if I call them that, your style, your presence, how polished your slides are, how you appear, how you come across. And yet you seem to be focused on quality of content and quality of thought, critical thinking behind what you're producing. How did you get better at that, David? How do you develop, if others wanted to, that content skill?
That's a very good question. And I think I can only answer it on the basis of my personal experience.
That's what we want, David.
And that is, it certainly improves the more that you do it. It improves, I think, if you have a situation where at the end of your presentation you have questions. And I've always tried then to reflect on the questions I've received and go back to the presentation and ask myself, could I have forestalled that question by having a different approach to the presentation? Should I have included more background? Should I have included more detail here? Should I have not addressed this topic because it's not central to the message I'm trying to convey? So I think that for me, I've improved my focus by iterating in that way over time. Having said that, maybe I would also say that if I had improved the other things that you were referring to, Paul, the style and the general nature of the presentation, maybe that would have improved things too. Mm-hmm. But for me, my focus and the way I handle this situation is be clear about the messaging, focus on the concepts and content, especially if the nature of the session is interactive. All I can say is that that's what works for me. Sure. Might not work for everyone else.
No, I hear that caveat, and that makes sense, David. And I wasn't at all, and I think my other content would bear this out, I wasn't at all suggesting that style and visual presentation and data visualization isn't good to master these skills as well. I'm absolutely a fan of that as well. But I was just aware, I think there's less airtime given these days, maybe, to the quality of your logical argument and your critical thinking and your mastery, including by practice, of your subject matter. I wonder, the subject matter bit and the practice, I get, and these things do come by time, and it's maybe a good message to be saying still, keep practicing and keep refining and iterating. Did you have any role models, anyone who helped you particularly with the quality of your argument, creating a cogent argument, improving your critical thinking? Have any people helped you with that over your career? Any you feel you've learned from?
Yes, I think in part this goes back to the bag carrier role, because the board member kindly took me on many visits he made to present papers. And although I had prepared his slides, I hadn't. He didn't read a speech. He just presented the slides. And I was always impressed how he took the content that I had provided and wove a story around it.
Right.
I think also there was a mentor I was very fortunate to have who worked for the board member, Jim Harrison, and we, they weren't presentations so much. He used to hold a series of meetings, seminar type meetings, yeah, on topics where, although it was a friendly atmosphere, if you hadn't marshaled your arguments, you would be taken to task, if I could put
right.
it like that.
Yes.
And yeah. And that was. That was actually a very good discipline to know that if you were going to a meeting and were going to talk on a particular topic, A, you had to do your research, but B, having done your research, you had to think very clearly about how you were going to approach that, what arguments you were going to make, and how you were going to justify them. So I think it was almost an academic level of rigor.
Yes, yes. Yeah, no, it comes across as that, like a really effective, experienced university professor who uses those tutor groups in a great accountability mechanism. No, thank you. That's great, David. One last question that I'd really like to give opportunity for, because of, sorry, me stressing your number of years of experience makes it sound like I'm suggesting you're ancient. I don't mean it.
I am.
I genuinely value the experience. After these years working in analytics and modeling, I wonder whether you have any lessons for today's data community. You know, you've seen it change and evolve a lot over the years. Any lessons you'd want to pass on to those who are data and analytics practitioners coming up through the ranks today? What have you learned that you think is most important to pass on?
I think there is one thing, but I would first want to put out a caveat that my exposure has been mainly in the context of the marketing community and marketing analytics. And the big thing, even now, is when I would start a consultancy project, getting hold of the data in the right form and checking its consistency is a real pain and is time consuming, and there's scope for errors. So I think the one focus I would have is in recording and organizing fundamental data for a business. Well, that's true whether it's media, you know, what was the content in this campaign? When did it start? When did it finish?
Yeah.
Some media channels are easier than others. Out of home is still problematic. Through to price and promotions, which promotions ran when, in which multiple grocers, trying to get all of that organized is difficult and time consuming, expensive, and makes the analytics more susceptible to errors, you know, if you can't rely on the data.
That is interesting to hear from you. I mean, it bears out with my experience, though it's a couple of decades ago now, really, as hands-on. But I was always surprised how much harder it was to get decent data on what the organization had done in its own marketing than it was to get customer data, external data, sociodemographic data, financial data. Almost the hardest to get hold of was what your own company had done in terms of its marketing. I suppose I assumed with the rise of marketing automation and marketing ops systems, that would have improved. Are you saying it's just as bad as ever?
I can honestly say I've not noticed a step change in improvement. There are incremental changes, but it is still an issue, well, in my view.
Thank you for sharing, David. A good clarion call for those who have a chance to sort out the data, capture it better, keep up the quality of it, of your marketing activity. Great stuff. That's been great. Thanks for your thoughts and many thanks for your time today, David. It has been great to chat with you. It's always good to catch up. Been a delight to have you share your experience with us. Thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Paul. Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you found that helpful and continue to listen to the Customer Insight Leader podcast. More great interviews coming up. And there's also regular content on our blog, customerinsightleader.com. So you might want to check that out too. Before then, it just remains for me to say thanks to everyone again for your time. Have a great week, and perhaps you can reflect on particularly David's emphasis on content, that subject matter expertise, that really preparing your argument, knowing your critical thinking, your cogent logical argument. Could you be doing more work on that, and how could you improve? Okay, plenty to mull on. Bye for now.